board would consider the statement sufficient enough to establish the element of reliability. But based on the lack of specificity of the facts and personal knowledge of the informant, the search warrant should be quashed and the evidence suppressed. The evidence be suppressed. That is, the evidence that was recovered from the garage. Next paragraph. The necessity of showing present possession versus future possession of contraband in a search warrant. Assuming the information you see was sufficient under Aguilar, it is normally required that the affidavit demonstrate that show sufficient probable cause you see to believe that the contraband to be seen is presently at the location to be searched. However, in the case of narcotics, it is usually sufficient to show an anticipated future delivery. Thus, the fact that the affidavit not contain a statement of present possession would not be fatal in this case, since the delivery was expected on a specific date, Friday. Fine. But in addition, a search warrant is a general requirement. You must describe with particularity the places to be searched and what contraband is to be found at that location. The warrant here describes Smith's apartment and the house owned by Smith or occupied by his estranged wife. It did not specifically include the garage where the marijuana was found. Usually the search warrant will describe the main premises and say all purchases there too. You give authority to search the purchase. So if this garage was unconnected, the search warrant might be effectively fatal. But if the garage is connected to the house, it would probably be considered to be a part of the house and therefore within the scope of the permissible area to be searched. Assuming that it was connected to the house and it was permissible to search the garage under this search warrant. Next paragraph.
Criminals will think, well, if I don't keep it in my place,
together, or 8 or 9 or 10, wherever it was. This is probably 10, 14, 13 characters. You might mention in this problem, as an aside, that it is not significant that only a usable quantity of marijuana was actually discovered when the search warrant was issued for a large shipment. Because you're not testing it, the validity of the search and the search warrant by hindsight, but by foresight. You can neither pull yourself up by the bootstraps because you find something there, therefore the search warrant is valid, nor can you cross your warrant based upon what was recovered in the search being different than what was asked for in the search warrant. Because if the officer has the authority to search, and then in searching he sees something in plain sight that is contraband, for example, he can discover stolen property in the apartment if he has the authority to search the house, and if he sees an item there with a serial number scratched off of that, he may seize that as potentially stolen property, even though the search warrant is not authorized to seize stolen property, because he's in there with probable cause, and then that would be an item that he could seize and detain in order to, not under the search warrant, but otherwise, in order to investigate a crime which is, you know, something that is plainly visible. All right, now, resisting arrest, a substantive crime of resisting arrest. The net result, you see, of all of this analysis of the search warrant is that for a number of reasons, the search warrant falls and the evidence that was seized in the garage can be quashed. And that can have a significant effect on the validity of the arrest in some jurisdictions. All right, now, resisting arrest. It is a misdemeanor to resist an arrest. An essential element of this offense is that the arrest be lawful. Thus, if it is later determined that the officer, acting here without a warrant and lacking probable cause to arrest the defendant, and therefore the arrest would be unlawful, a defendant could not be convicted of this offense. Now, you've got to distinguish. It might be important to show your knowledge of the law that although he could be convicted of a simple battery if he used force, or a felony if he used excessive force to defend himself against arrest, because today no one is entitled to use any force to resist an arrest, whether it be lawful or unlawful. Even though in early common law you could use reasonable force to resist an unlawful arrest. But in the battery situation, lawfulness of the arrest is not an essential element. You see, but in a resisting arrest, the lawfulness of the arrest is an essential element, and he's charged here only with resisting arrest. Therefore, he can raise the issue of the lawfulness of the arrest as a defensive matter. Or they're required to prove the lawfulness of the arrest as an affirmative part of the people's case. The issue to this question turns on the lawfulness of the arrest, since the fact stipulated that Smith resisted the arrest. Now, he was arrested for a misdemeanor, possession of marijuana. This arrest was without an arrest warrant. Thus, it must be governed by the rule of warrantless arrest. And as a general rule, a peace officer may make an arrest without a warrant for a misdemeanor only when that misdemeanor is committed in his presence. The possession of marijuana here was not committed by Smith in the officer's presence. They later located Smith and arrested him, so he was not at the premises at the time the marijuana was discovered. Thus, the arrest was unlawful, and Smith could not be convicted of resisting under the general rule. There are a few states, though, that allow for arrest of a misdemeanor based upon probable cause only. No presence is required. In those states, it doesn't say which state you're in, you know, so you've got to handle the minority rule. In those states, Smith could be convicted since the officers had probable cause to believe a crime had been committed, possession of marijuana, and reasonable cause to believe that Smith did it, based upon two facts, really. One, the information supplied by the informant, which has now been corroborated, you see, by the discovery of a usable quantity of marijuana in Smith's garage. However, initial search and recovery of the marijuana from the garage was unconstitutional, then the evidence discovered could not be used by the officers to corroborate the information given by the informant, and could not be used to show that a crime of possession had in fact been committed, because when marijuana is there, someone is in possession of it. Because these facts that they are now using for probable cause are the fruits of a poison tree. They are the product of the initial illegal search under the invalid search warrant. And most states do follow the doctrine of the fruits of the poison tree, even though it has not yet been mandated by the Supreme Court as a part, as a constitutional part, you see, of the exclusionary rule. In other words, through the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. Thus, the officers would lack here probable cause to support the arrest of been even in the majority jurisdictions without a warrant. Now, what is the effect of this unlawful arrest on the personal search of Smith and his state, "That ain't my marijuana"? The validity of the personal search of Smith, since it was made immediately after he was arrested, immediately in the back of the house, must turn on the validity of the arrest. A search is valid only if it is incidental to a valid arrest. Now, if the search warrant is clogged and the officer lacks probable cause to arrest the defendant, or if this is an arrest that's illegal because it's not made, it's not a misdemeanor in the officer's presence, then the arrest is invalid. And if the arrest is invalid, there can be no search in any item to cover. In other words, again, the items that are recovered are tainted by the illegality of the arrest. Likewise, the court would suppress any oral statements taken from the defendant immediately after his arrest, based upon the fruits of the poison tree doctrine, and especially in a case where the defendant is not Mirandized. That is a factor that the courts often take into consideration in determining whether or not, you see, the search can be separated from the invalid arrest. If you can find a legal basis for the search and separate it from the invalid arrest, then you might be able to justify the search or justify the oral statement. But where there has been no Mirandizing as far as the oral statement is concerned, the court would readily conclude that statement is received as a product of the initial illegal arrest, and therefore is the proof of the poison tree and not to be admitted. Now, remember that if I'm dealing with Smith's statement, "That ain't my marijuana," and the constitutional issue raised by failure to Mirandize, you should demonstrate in your analysis why this is a statement you would want to keep out as Smith's lawyer, because that's a part of the call of the question. So you must demonstrate that while it appears to be exculpatory in its nature, it is really incriminating because it goes to the element of knowledge of the marijuana contained in the garage. And for that reason, it is a very damaging admission. And Miranda and the constitutional provisions to be free from self-incrimination apply not only to confession, but also to an admission. And this is at best only an admission. According to Miranda versus Arizona, the Supreme Court has held that the police cannot use a statement, whether it is even exculpatory or inculpatory, as far as that goes, stemming from a custodial interrogation, unless the defendant is first advised of his constitutional right to be free from self-incrimination, to be free from self-incrimination, guaranteed by the, that's the fifth of the sixth amendment, the fifth amendment. I said the sixth before, I meant the fifth amendment. And his right to counsel, guaranteed by the sixth amendment. Now, someone had suggested to me earlier that maybe there was a recent Supreme Court decision called Kirby versus something.
Illinois.
Kirby versus Illinois, which has ruled that to a post indictment.
No right to counsel,
As far as the lineup is concerned, or as far as Miranda is concerned?
Lineup
only, all right. Now, I had completely forgotten about that, or if I heard about it, I didn't remember about it, so I'm going to have to do some checking on that. If that is the case, then it would affect the answer that I gave to the other problem, which was an old answer that I prepared for an old question, when Wade versus the United States was still very much the law. And so what you would have to do in response to that question, if that is the law, is Kirby versus Illinois, to point out that the Supreme Court in the past has taken the position that since that a critical stage of the proceeding was reached in the case of a lineup, that you were entitled to the right of counsel. And then to point out, however, that recently the Supreme Court has retreated from that position. It's held that the critical stage of a proceeding as far as the right to counsel is concerned is not reached until post-indictment. Somebody else? So this is an issue that I haven't had to attack, so I wasn't even aware of.
That's wherever substantial rights of the defendant can be affected, that's where he has the right to counsel.
Well, not according to these people invited by Kirby versus Illinois, but what I'm pointing out to you is and sometimes the law is never left an incriminating statement, and it was made in response, you see, to a question, so there was interrogation. And the subsequent advice of the constitutional right is likewise insignificant, but this is especially where he refused to talk and demanded an attorney. Now, a possible issue that could be raised in this problem I said before is that if the search warrant is valid, and the subsequent seizure of the marijuana at the garage was valid, then you might want to, as Smith's attorney, demand the disclosure of the name of the informant on the theory that the informant could possibly offer evidence on the issue of possession, identity of the person who possessed the goods, the marijuana. And even though the informant told the officer, see in the affidavit, that it was Smith's shipment, it is possible that when the informant actually got there in court under oath, he might say that, no, that wasn't Smith's stuff in the garage, that was mine and someone else's. And you don't have to demonstrate in this issue that he's going to give favorable evidence to the defense. You only have to demonstrate that he might be able to show the information that could be usable by the defense. And if you can do that, then you can demonstrate that you have the right. And if it goes to an essential element of the defense, such as here, the identity of the defendant as the accused who possessed that marijuana, you are entitled to the disclosure of the name of the informant. And if they refuse to disclose the name of the informant, you're entitled to have sanctions imposed for that failure to disclose the name of the informant. And one of the sanctions that would more likely be imposed is that they would not admit the evidence that was seized as a result of the information given by the informant. And if you could do that, then it means you could defend against the charge of possession of marijuana. And that then is a final to that. If anybody has, we're going to take a 5-minute break. Plans to murder A to use the gas apparatus. And then, for the purpose obviously of securing him's agreement to assist him, he encouraged and solicited him to commit a felony, burglary, and murder. The solicitation or encouraging by words is the act itself, satisfying the criminal requirement that every crime consists of an act, the actus rea and criminal intent, the mens rea, the latter satisfied here by the specific intent to encourage another to do a criminal act. I think it's always important to point out, in discussing solicitation, to point out that the verbalization, the solicitation itself, the encouragement itself is a criminal act, satisfying the common law requirement that in every crime there must be the joint operation of act and criminal intent. Conspiracy, paragraph 2. Since M apparently agreed to assist D in his plan to murder A by helping him install the gas apparatus, D and M combined to commit an unlawful murder. Thus committed a crime conspiracy, a misdemeanor in common law. And any time you have a conspiracy, you should always establish an overt act. Because most states, they require an overt act. common law, once the agreement was made, being in the mind, being deceived for criminal purpose, the crime is complete. Moderately, an overt act in furtherance of the plan is required. That is easily satisfied here by the installation of the gas apparatus. Three, attempted murder of A. And notice I said attempted murder of A. At common law, one committed an attempt, a misdemeanor, when with a specific intent to commit a particular offense, he did an act which constituted a substantial step toward the consummation of that offense. There is little question here that both D and M had a specific crime in mind, murder of A. But what act, if any, by D or M constituted a substantial step toward consummation of that crime? The test is one of distinguishing between perpetrating and preparatory acts. Perpetration and preparation. While it's clear that when M subsequently generated the poison gas, this was an act of perpetration, an act so dangerous to near the consummation of the crime that it is likely the crime is likely to occur but for some, you know, interference at the last moment. And here it was broken window. The crime may have been committed earlier by both M and D when they installed the gas apparatus and connected it to the pipe leading to A's room. Ordinarily, this kind of conduct would be considered preparation because it is so remote from the actual commencement of the perpetration. But the court had developed a doctrine that would allow this to be considered perpetrating, and that doctrine is the so-called dangerous act doctrine. Under this principle, the remoteness of the commission, or rather the remoteness of the consummation of the offense, becomes a less significant factor in distinguishing, you see, between perpetration and preparation. Where the act done is particularly dangerous, the courts say, it will be considered perpetrating, even though it is remote from the consummation. And many more acts are needed to be done in order to accomplish the target crime. Installing a poisonous gas generator and connecting it to pipes that lead to someone's bedroom is so dangerous that it might be considered an act of preparation rather than mere preparation. And a substantial step in toward consummating the offense. And paragraph 5, since the defendant and M had the apparent possibility of carrying out the target crime of murder, the gas was an effective means to commit to kill someone. That is the test of apparent possibility, and whether or not the means used is effective for the purpose it's designed to do, and gas is an effective means of killing someone. So they have the apparent possibility. And there existed in this case no legal impossibility, which is usually a question of lack of juridical capacity. The fact that the windows were open, you see, and that B didn't die, or that A was not there and he couldn't be killed, is not a legal impossibility, but only a factual impossibility. And factual impossibilities are not defenses to an attempt, only legal impossibilities. Paragraph 6. Assuming, however, that the attempt was not committed until M turned on the gas generator, this raises several issues concerning the defendant's responsibility for this offense. It is true that one may effectively withdraw, you see, from a conspiracy and insulate himself from criminal responsibility for crimes thereafter committed. And one may abandon an attempt by his accomplice before the attempt is consummated if he effectively communicates his intentions to withdraw to his fellow conspirators or his accomplice. And while D here became ill and left the state, this was only a temporary thing. And there is no evidence in this case that he had any real intent to abandon his criminal purpose or that he communicated that, if such intention existed, to his accomplice and co-conspirator M. Thus, the defendant is responsible for attempted murder of A. Remember I said A again, we'll talk about that in a moment. Even though he was not physically present in the state at the time. target crime of the conspiracy is a crime committed in the furtherance of the conspiracy. Or he's guilty as an accessory before the fact at common law and later as a principal in the second degree, one who has counseled, aided, or abetted, you see, another in the commission of the crime but was not present when the crime was actually committed. Again, we're talking about attempted murder of A. 7. As a result, then, D and M are both guilty of an attempt to murder A, not B. And this is really the significant issue in this problem, who happened to be in the room at the time the gas was turned on. This is true because attempted murder is a specific intent crime. And D and M intended to murder A, not B. If B had been killed by the gas, D and M would have been guilty of the murder of B, in that their conduct was done with malice, you see, and malice doesn't require any specific ill will toward a specific person. But if the charge is going to be attempted murder, it must be the attempted murder of A, not the victim B, who was injured. And the failure to so charge, you see, the crime that the attempted murder of A would be fatal. Could not be convicted here of the attempt to murder B, because there was no specific intent to murder B, only a specific intent to murder A. Battery of B. Remember, the question you see is what crime has been committed? The crime is the attempted murder of A, not the attempted murder of B. But battery of B. By the same reasoning, D and M could be charged as victim of a battery of B, not A, since it was B who was the victim of the gas, not A. While M was the principal, the actor, in turning on the gas, D is liable to the same theory that we expressed before, conspiracy, statement of rule, and accessory before the fact, under the common law. In battery, the only real issue here is the application of force. Was there a harmful touching by him? The application of gas was certainly harmful. He became ill and he was injured. There was a touching by the gas, which was the instrumentality, you see, of him and me. And in common law, the touching could be accomplished indirectly where the defendant set in motion a force. Here's the gas, which came in contact with his victim. And the next issue that has to be recognized and negated is the doctrine of transferred intent, which is paragraph 9. Even though the battery, the touching, was intended for A, not B, nevertheless, the offense is still committed, battery. Not because the intent to injure A is transferred to B, but because the defendant acted with criminal intent. An intent to commit a particular crime against a particular victim is sufficient to constitute the mens rea of a battery or murder, even though you reach an unintended victim. The one exception, as pointed out supra, is attempted murder, where it is essential to allege and prove a victim. You see, there really is no such thing in the law of crime as transferred intent. You will find cases that use the court fiction of transferred intent to satisfy the requirement of a criminal intent in a case. You will find cases discussed that those cases are inaccurate as a matter of historical significance. In every case where you find transferred intent as used to satisfy the element of intent,